At Bamboo in the Wind, the center that I practice at in Sunnyvale, we are in the midst of Mindfulness Month. It's the month that we designate for bringing awareness and more renewed vigor around the practices of mindfulness. We had our first mindfulness class this past Thursday, and one of the topics I wanted to share this morning is the differences between what I would consider to be secular mindfulness versus religious mindfulness, at least as a excuse me, as a starting point. So in defining mindfulness, we could say that what we're doing is bringing attention or awareness around our activities in a non-judgmental way. And, excuse me, we're being present with what we're doing. Now, excuse me. This non-evaluative or non-judgmental activity in everyday life, particularly now we know mindfulness has become more popularized in the secular world. Recently in HuffPost, in May, there was an article about the 5 tips for mindfulness. And they basically were on mindfulness and brushing your teeth, and driving or commuting to work. Another one was standing in line, taking a shower, and...
I can't remember.
Anyway, there were 5. Maybe it'll come to us. But washing the dishes. Now, if you think about what's common to all of these are external practices, right? We're bringing awareness to the activities outside of ourselves, what we're doing, which is valid, you know, valid, because we need to wake up about that too. Mindfulness is so popular that Google has had a recent seminar, conference on, and they had labeled it Mindfulness 2.0. And they brought in, you know, the heavyweights, Thich Nhat Hanh, you know, he's pretty well known for his mindfulness practices. He's got many books out on the subject, mindfulness, present moment, you know. Mindfulness is really, I think, in many ways we could attribute to him being the person who, at least from my own experience of popularizing this practice, but, you know, that's just my limited experience. So we have examples of mindfulness in the secular world. And what I thought more about is not only are they external to us, to, you know, our, you know, mental processes, but also they have a tendency to be goal-oriented. The goal there is, in the case of Google, of course, is the profit motive, which, you know, is valid. Profit motive, because mindful employees actually focus and concentrate and get their work done. It has some real bottom line effects. So one can see why companies would support this kind of practice. Now, if we look at mindfulness in a more religious sense, we would say that the practices are really more about our interior life. So we're looking now inwards at what is arising in the mind and how are we responding to what is going on in the external world. But it's really about what's happening in the mind. Also, a big difference with the religious sense, at least for Buddhists, is that mindfulness is a foundational practice, which is for practitioners, bodhisattvas, who make a vow to liberate all beings. And so that vow is different motivation than the prophet motive. It's a vow to liberate all beings, including, of course, the self, oneself. So those, I think, are large distinctions. In addition, if we think about, well, right now, mindfulness is kind of trendy here in America. But, you know, Buddha taught mindfulness 2,500 years ago. So we can look to the teachings in Theravada as well as in Mahayana to provide us with more instruction about mindfulness. And there are quite a few teachings. Now, when we look in Theravada, the teaching specifically that I'm referring to is the Jhanas, which the first one, oh, well, I don't know, this isn't the first Jhana, but when in speaking about mindfulness, the Jhana would be on concentration. That would be the first related matter. So mindfulness, where one is aware that the mind is concentrated, is a basic practice. And many of you probably have heard about the four foundations of mindfulness, a sutra that's found in the middle-length discourses of the body, of the Buddha, which is mindfulness of the breath, mindfulness of the body, mindfulness of feelings, mindfulness of consciousness, the mind. So, looking now at what's going on in Mahayana, we could start with the teaching that dates back to probably the one I'm going to refer to anyway is based on the five ranks, which is Dongshan's teaching that was from 9th century China. And one of the subsequent supporting and developed frameworks around the five ranks was written by Hakuin, who is our 18th century ancestor in Japan in the Rinzai tradition. So Dongshan was really more considered the father of Soto Zen, if we go back, you know, beyond Dogen. He was for China. So now we're in the midst of the 18th century with Hakuin, and he has developed a framework called the Four Cognitions. And it ties together the way that one experiences mindfulness. And the first step is in what he calls, I think it's the universal, let me see if I can get the correct name, universal mirror cognition. And in this universal mirror cognition, what he's really speaking about is what we experience in Zazen. We have the dropping off of body and mind when we actually experience the precious mirror. We have a sense, an experience of oneness. And in this oneness, there's undifferentiation and vastness. There's also a contemporary Zen master, whose name is Sokeyan, he's from 1930s or 40s. He taught in New York. He came from Japan. And he has a parallel system with just different labels. He calls universal mirror wisdom, mirror-like wisdom. I'm sorry, universal mirror cognition is Hakuin's, and then the mirror-like wisdom is Sokeyan. So he has a system called the four wisdoms versus four cognitions versus the Theravada teaching of the Jhanas. So what we can see is that, you know, practitioners from early on have had some sense when they look inward about, you know, what's really troubling them. Some people, you know, have a sense of being tugged by desire or being tossed about by their feelings that they may have expressed but have not come back to them and been returned, or maybe they've been discarded or discounted. So from each of these things we can see that very early on in all of these systems, we're actually waking up to some very basic levels of suffering, and then practices that might help us to wake up to them. We know that it doesn't matter whether you're a beginner in this practice or whether you've been practicing a very long time, suffering is there, and we experience it. So we need to have some practices that will help us to have some relief. So in concentration, where we have one-pointedness, the practice is to let go of our hindrances, our obstructions. So what are those hindrances? They're the classics, right? Attachment or aversion, worldly desire, restlessness and worry, sloth and torpor. And, of course, then we cannot ignore another one, which would be distraction. It's not in the list, but it's in mine. I don't know about you, but I was trying to be mindful in just trying to relax one evening, you know, to help with my mindful digestion. And so I was laying down, and you know, I noticed the very first thing I did was I reached over and got my phone. Distraction. I was supposed to be resting my eyes so I could have better digestion. So that's a good reason to pick up the phone. Check email. Distraction. We have many. I think about, you know, TV, you know, I mean, we just have so many. It's not that they didn't have many back then, I just don't think they categorized it like, you know, now we know all we have to do is look around. Anywhere you go, walk down the street, walk into a grocery store. I mean, even in a park, you're supposed to be, you know, in with nature and you got somebody on the phone. So we have a lot of distractions, and I think our smartphones are a classic already, and it's only been how many years? So there was another hindrance, a classic hindrance, and that is speculative doubt. Doubt about the practice. Doubt about you know, people get into this thinking about, oh, well, what is it like after death? And Buddha would say, not an issue. This isn't of something we concern ourselves with. We talk about what's happening right here, right now. That's what we're concerned with. So all these hindrances have, get in the way of us actually waking up, which is really what this practice is about. Our practice is about waking up to our true self. And so one must become familiar with the internal processes going on within yourself in order to see the hindrances, in order to start peeling back that fixed notion or fixed feeling or belief or object that we've somehow internalized as something that is immovable and prevents us from really becoming who we truly are. So in Zazen, when we experience what's going on, we're actually seeing the content of our lives. We see these obstructions, and the teaching is to see them and then let them go. And so over time, as we sit and face the wall and ourselves, we start seeing the habits, the mind habits of where does our mind like to go all the time? How does it like to repeat those same stories over and over again? And we've all heard them. We all hear our own stories, but we like them. There's a certain amount of like that goes along with our own stories.
Attachment,
there you go. It's very clear when you sit and hear your stories over and over again. So once you see that, observing it is the first step to actually this process of letting go and going into transformation. And then you can ask the question, well, now who's in control? So in thinking back now into the Jhanas or the Theravadin teaching, when we transform these hindrances from negative to neutral through applied effort, let them go, this concentration results. From concentration, the next step in Theravadin teaching is equanimity. Equanimity here is, I had to look up the word. I don't know about you, but sometimes I encounter words that I think are defined one way, and then I go check them out. It's like, oh, I have to rethink this. So I checked out in the American Heritage Dictionary about what is the definition of equanimity. And I learned that, of course, yes, it's about being calm and even-tempered. Yes, that's true. About composure. But it also, composure implies mental balance. And then evenness in responding. And then it also is really a description of the characteristic state when we talk about equanimity. And that's a key point here. When we talk about equanimity, and maybe I'll get to that a little bit later, but keep that in mind. So another synonym for equanimity is, besides composure, is serenity, tranquility, that suggests an imperviousness to agitation or turmoil. So, serenity. Yeah. So that's a full range in everyday life, you know, of what we have here in equanimity. Now, for Hakuin, he takes this a little bit further. Remember, he's in the four cognitions. The first one was the universal mirror cognition, and the second now is the cognition of equality. So what does he mean by that? So the cognition of equality. So here, one experiences not only the universal essence, but all things in the six sense fields. Now remember, when we talk of Yogacara, speaks of there's how the body and, you know, mind relates to the environment. And so the sense fields are really like the objects out there. So we have the sense organ, we have the sense consciousness like hearing, and then the sense field, which is the object. So everything in the sense field now is equal, right? Everything is the enlightened nature of reality. And that means to be in this state, the practitioner actually shines through the appearances of things and experiences their true nature, which is the essence of reality. In other words, you begin to see and experience that things are impermanent, that things do not have a fixed self, and that, yes, there is suffering. So along with that experience, one perceives and experiences the interconnectedness of all reality. So you can see his understanding of the cognition of equality is deeper and asks more of the practitioner in terms of actually experiencing the cognition of equality. Because in order to arrive or achieve this state, you actually have to continually refine your practice. And that means you think you may have transformed some hindrance, some aspect, some habitual way of thinking or behaving or responding, but it may have only been transformed in one instance, in one situation. It didn't get transformed in every possible way that it may show up in your life. And so there's continually refinement that must go on. And that's why I'm so grateful all of you are here, because this is a refinement process. This willingness to sit and actually observe what arises in the mind and letting it go is what it takes. We have to suspend that judgment that comes up just spontaneously. It just arises. It's just like, whoop. And it's because that's how we're wired. As soon as we perceive something, what immediately comes out is appropriating mind. That's the alaya vijnana. That's the out of, you know, our seventh consciousness or eighth consciousness, we have this appropriating mind coming out and designating something already. And we don't even know it's happening in so instantaneously, nanoseconds, whatever. We don't even see that happening. So to catch that, you have to really pay attention to what's going on in the mind. So when you're actually off the cushion, you can spot it. You can spot that appropriating mind. Appropriating mind means that something's up, it's grasping. So it may grasp at the appearance of something or the feeling or the idea. That's appropriating mind. It's just jumps right out. So to know that we're wired this way means you have to even be more vigilant, because appropriating mind will take over before you even have time to think about it. Well, one of the ways you can tune into appropriating mind is to observe your preferences. So we all have preferences. I mean, I prefer having this little stand here. So it isn't that preferences are bad. We're not talking about good or bad. What we're talking about is, how do those preferences really color your reality to the point that they actually become obstructions? And there's a subtlety here that you just need to work with in your practice so that you can start seeing. If you find that you start putting a stake in the ground and holding your position, and you find that, you know, feelings start coming up and, you know, you start to have some agitation or frustration, or, you know, you can feel some tensing in the body about this or that, those are clues that you have something going on here that's not soft, not malleable, and may in fact be an area to look at and start investigating how much you're invested in that belief or feeling or response. There's some thoughts by Mizumi Roshi, who was the Zen Center of Los Angeles abbot for a number of years. And he talks about that, you know, the difference. He talks about enlightenment and delusion. And he said that if we really identify with everything else, we really identify with everything else, and we've dropped our preferences and our separation, that, you know, and acknowledge that we're enlightenment itself, as is everything and everybody, we start experiencing life as Buddha. Everything is Buddha. So whatever you're doing, there's nothing extra that's added. And it shouldn't upset or disturb you. Now, on the flip side, there's delusion. And when you really experience and know delusion, you are delusion. And you have to experience that to really know delusion. Because in delusion, there's really no separation from delusion. You're just deluded. So it's okay. We need to experience. Delusion is what our life is. We're pretty deluded about, I would give it about 90% of our life. I mean, we don't see reality as it really is. We haven't been trained. So that's why we're here too today, is to train ourselves, to train our mind, to wake up to the nature of reality, which is impermanent. It is suffering. It is not fixed. So we need to take those difficult steps. The name that Sokian uses to this cognition of equality is called undiscerning wisdom. So in the word discern in Buddhism has a different value, it's a very positive meaning. So when you discern something as opposed to designate or differentiate, differentiation is meaning you're seeing all the myriad things. When you discern, you're at a different level. And so undiscerning wisdom, you're actually at an even deeper level. And you're into the wisdom aspect of reality, not in the differentiation of myriad forms. So in letting go of our of the appearances of things, deepening our awareness, we can and do experience compassion. So I would like to share Meizumi Roshi's three kinds of compassion. The first is one we're well acquainted with, which is basically that we have compassion towards others when we want to relieve their suffering. But there's also a more advanced stage of compassion, which is toward phenomena. So now we've up-leveled it a little bit. Instead of just having compassion toward individual beings, people, we start having compassionate to all phenomena. All phenomena. So if you think about it, the phenomena is picking up the glass with a certain reverence and drinking the water with the reverence that it is Buddha. This comes through practice and understanding. And then the third type is having no particular relation to whatever is. You just spontaneously respond as the bodhisattvas that you all are on the path. Mm-hmm. So, please treasure yourself. I heard the bell. I was being mindful. It's lunch, as John would say. It's lunch. Get with the program, Val. Do we have any time? No time?
Time is an illusion.
Anyway, it's a mental construct, yes. Indeed. Anybody have any thoughts or comments on it? Or did I stop the clock?
Can I ask you more about the undiscerning wisdom?
Mm-hmm.
Can you kind of further expand?
Undiscerning. Well, I think, you know, there's, you know, one of them we can tell about no preferences, right? That's one aspect of it. So undiscerning wisdom is actually moving more into the awakened nature of reality. So you start experiencing the sense that things aren't that separate from you. Mm-hmm. That there you have a connection that you know inside is there. Mm-hmm. And you're connected with it. So when we sit, we actually are purifying ourselves with this kind of daily attention to our sitting. And that form, it's a form of purification. It cleanses the mind. If you think about it, if you don't sit versus a day you do sit, the difference is pretty big. It's significant. And why is that? Because you're processing. You're processing what's going on in the mind when you're sitting in zazen. It's showing up and you're observing it and letting it go. So this actually purifies the mind and allows that prajna to come up so that you do begin to have this experience of the interconnectedness of all being.
Sometimes it's important to pound that stake in the ground and state a view. And then you state your view, and it seems like if it's heard, the stake pops out of the ground and it's like you're done with it. And to use an example, when many people work together, there comes a time on what people are working together on to make a decision and to offer commentary. And so you do. Mm-hmm. But then you also move on to the next step. Mm-hmm. So I would encourage the putting in the stake, but also knowing that it comes out again. Mm-hmm. Instead of like, oh, I shouldn't be taking a stance.
Right.
So.
Agreed. I think what you pointed out is that there you weren't fixated on the idea. So as soon as you can put the stake in the ground, but is it fixed? And if you'd hold on to it, I think what John was saying earlier, that's attachment. If you felt that if you couldn't resolve, because there might have been differences of opinion and your commentaries and whatever, and if you felt that somehow you had to invest more energy in maintaining that position instead of letting go and process and allow the process to unfold, then you become stuck. So putting the stake in the ground is good. It allows you to express yourself and manifest your true self. But where the difference is in holding on to it and thinking it's fixed.